This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
Welcome to a Joycast from Joy 94.9. Visit joy.org.au to find out more about our Joycasts.
Nothing is sacred, and the team will be finding the queer and profane wherever we can on Joy 94.9. Is nothing sacred?
Hi there, Joysters. This is Jim, and I'm here with Kurt and Steph and James, and we've got a guest in the studio tonight, Tony Pittman, and we'll be talking to Tony in a minute. And we've got another guest that we're about to call, Lisa Daniel from the Melbourne Queer Film Festival. And this is Nothing Sacred, and we're streaming also on Sydney Star Observer Digital Radio, your sex, sexuality and gender diverse radio station in Sydney, running for Mardi Gras. Happy Mardi Gras, all you Joysters in Sydney.
Yay, happy
and
Mardi
Steph,
Gras.
And Steph, you're just home from Sydney tonight.
I am just home from Sydney. I have to say, I think Sydney is definitely outdoing us in the rainbowness stakes, because Sydney Airport had rainbow flags up everywhere, even along the, you know, in like the makeup section in the duty free where everything's...
Did you go to a gay TM?
What's a gay TM?
An ATM, ANZ's, I'm not allowed to say that.
No.
One of the banks.
That bank has got gay TMs everywhere. They've dressed all their ATMs up through Oxford Street in glitter and sparkles.
That's very exciting.
Like that.
I didn't see that. I did see lots of rainbow flags.
I want to know if you get the pink dollar out of it.
Ha, 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 ha. It did make me think that we could do a little bit better. Because it's a thing, like, it being in Sydney during Mardi Gras, you go into a shop, you buy a Big M or whatever, and people say, oh, Happy Mardi Gras. It's more of a community feel.
That's because they know you're a lesbian.
No one says Happy Midsummer. People only say Happy Midsummer on Carnival Day or Happy Pride at Pride March. They don't say Happy Midsummer outside. I think we should change that. Well, I'm putting it to you people of Melbourne.
I think that is true. I think Mardi Gras has got into the consciousness of Sydney more than Midsummer has got into the consciousness of Melbourne.
You're listening to a Joycast from GLBTIQ community radio station Joy 94.9.
You're with James, Kurt, Steph and Pat on Is Nothing Sacred? Joy 94.9.
Hi there, Joysters. You are on Is Nothing Sacred on Joy 94.9. And you can email us on air at joy.org.au, or you can SMS us on 0427JOY949. Or you can call Robert on the front desk. Robert's on program support tonight on 1300 JOY949, and tell us what you think about what we're talking about. But we've got on the line at the moment Lisa Daniel, who's the artistic director of the Melbourne Queer Film Festival. Hi there, Lisa. Are you there?
Evening. How are you going?
Good. Welcome to It's Nothing Sacred.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
It's a real pleasure. And the first thing I'm going to ask you is, is there anything controversial in MQFF this year? You've had nothing banned, have you, this year?
Nothing banned.
Is that because you've given in to authority?
No, there just wasn't anything particularly controversial around this year, I've got to say. Of course, last year we had the Travis Matthews film banned by the Office of Film and Lit Classification, or the Classification Board as it's known now. I've got my classification exemption application in at the moment, but I don't expect there's going to be any kind of controversy. I mean, there's probably things that people might think might be controversial in terms of Bruce LaBruce, for any of those who know, is quite a sort of controversial Canadian filmmaker whose film LA Zombie was banned a couple of years ago, I think, in Melbourne.
But weren't those films eventually shown at the Underground Film Festival?
Yeah, but he actually went... the director of that festival actually had to go to court over that in the end. So, and I think the fine is fairly stiff. Anyway, Bruce LaBruce has got a new film out called Gerontophilia, and I sort of expected we might get asked to supply the screener for that, but we haven't yet. So, I mean, it's actually not controversial. It's a love story between a 22-year-old guy and an 85-year-old man. It's actually
some people would think that was controversial, but then they did allow... what's it, Anna Nicole Smith, didn't they?
Yes, that's true. But I suppose it's just Bruce LaBruce's reputation that precedes him, really, and this will surprise anybody who is expecting to see zombie porn, because it's nothing like that. It's completely the opposite.
What are some of the highlights that you think, or I guess recommendations for people to go and see this year?
Yeah, look, I have been telling people to go and see Gerontophilia, which is one of my favourite films. Another film that I really love is a Netherlands film called Matterhorn, which is, again, the sort of love story you just don't see anywhere on screen at the moment. I mean, it's sort of really new to me. When I saw it, I just thought, I have to get this film. It's really original. It's about a guy who's in his sort of mid-50s, lives in a small town in the Netherlands somewhere. He's a widower. He's got a... his child has died. He's a very conservative man. He's sort of a buttoned-up, cardigan-wearing type of guy. His wife has died many years previously. And he meets this guy who's sort of in his 40s who's known around his small town as someone who has an intellectual disability. And the two of them end up sort of, because they're both lonely and they have sort of no sort of friends or family, they end up sort of becoming friends. And then they form this really romantic, unlikely relationship. And I just absolutely love it. So Matterhorn is definitely one of my favourites. And of course, Jim would know that one of my other favourites is 52 Tuesdays.
Oh, of course, you have to mention that if I'm
which is Jim's daughter, Sophie, from Adelaide. So, and she's now back in the country after kicking lots of goals at Berlin and Sundance, winning awards, and we're incredibly chuffed to have her new film.
And she's going to be here just for the screening of that film on the 18th, and then I was told that she wasn't able to stay for the next film, which I have an interest in, of course, which I'm the subject of, which is Sun Rainbows Never Grey,
yes,
because she has to fly back to London for the closing session of the London Gay and Lesbian Film Festival.
It's a hard life.
It's a hard life. I offered to go in her place.
Yeah, you could have. Yeah, she's doing incredibly well. I love the film. I love what she's done with it. I love the fact that it was shot every Tuesday over a year. I love the trans story and the journey of the trans character. I love the teenage sort of sexuality and the sort of emergence of the young teenage girl's sexuality. I just, the performance is fantastic. It's beautifully written and probably one of my favourite Australian films from many years, actually.
Well, I personally think, being biased, a little biased, of course, I think it's going to be one of the sort of Australian cult films that lasts. Really, it's the best Australian queer film of the year.
Yeah, definitely. I think it's bigger than cult. I think it's going to do well. I don't think it's sort of... Cult to me implies it's going to be something that's sort of hidden away.
Well, it did really well at the Adelaide Film Festival. It was sold out every session that it had.
Well,
it's only having one showing, isn't it, from MQS?
Yeah, the deal is once only because it's been sold to an Australian distributor. It's got some screenings middle of the year, I think. And
sometime in May, I think it starts.
Yeah, May or June, I think it is. So, Sophie fought pretty hard to get it for the Melbourne Queer Film Festival, which we really appreciate, and she has a soft spot for the festival, having won an award here before for a short film a few years ago. But, she really could have sent it to any festival, and we're really rapt that she's given it to us. But, yeah, we only get one screening, so it will sell out. And it's selling incredibly well. I think it's pretty much half sold, and we've only been on sale for about 6 days. So.
Well, that's pretty good. I suppose I'd better get in there and buy a ticket.
You better. Well, you could chat to her about her comps.
Yes, I've already done that. Don't you worry.
This Joycast is a free service brought to you by Joy 94.9. Support Joy 94.9 by becoming a member at joy.org.au.
Yes, you are on Joy 94.9 and on Star Observer Digital in Sydney, your sex, sexuality and gender diverse station for all those Mardi Gras up there. And hello, Patrick in Sydney. I assume you're listening. Patrick, the other one of our team, is in Sydney this week doing what gay boys do in Sydney on Mardi Gras week, no doubt.
Running amok.
Oh, we just got to hear from anyway.
Lisa, you're still there, aren't you?
I am, yes.
I think James has got a very serious question for you.
Oh, no, it's not. It's not that serious. But, Lisa, I just, for somebody like even myself who hasn't really been to much of the festival before, could you tell us, our listeners, a little bit about the history of the festival and, why it's so important, perhaps less so now, but why it's been so important in the past?
I think it's actually as important as it has been across its 24 years. I mean, we're 24 this year. We're one of the oldest queer film festivals in the world. We're one of the largest queer film festivals in the world. And we started off, 24 years ago. I wasn't around then. I've been here for about 16 years, I think, 15, 16 years. So started before my time, and it's pretty much started at the back of Hares and Hyenas bookstore and started off as obviously a fairly small event and just has grown over the years. And I think in my time it's gone from about 30 sessions to 100, so it's had a lot of growth.
Wow.
But it's been really tough in the last 3 years. We haven't had a growth in audience for 3 years. We've made a financial loss in the last 2 years. And
So, Joysters, get online and buy your tickets now.
Yeah, it's really important.
It's crucially important. We still have a very high suicide rate in the queer community, both in cities and rurally. We're finding it really, really hard to get commercial sponsorship or corporate sponsorship because, you know, the line we're getting from people is, oh, you know, Modern Family's on TV, you know, there's queer characters on some television shows now. You don't really need a queer film festival anymore. Well, that's patently ridiculous. I mean, you know, one show on television on a Sunday night doesn't make for, you know, queer culture being accepted across the board. And, you know, that's just one tiny example. Modern Family is just one tiny example of the queer community. We're an incredibly diverse group. And we don't have equality. We might have pretty much equality in terms of legislation and legal aspects, but we, you know, we don't have equal marriage. You know, we certainly still get hated in the community. Whenever there's something in, say, the Herald Sun about the gay community, there's lots of, you know, hate letters to the editor and that sort of thing. So, you know, we're nowhere near not needing a...
And the other thing you do is you introduce really good films to the community, don't you? Because I
noticed... We do. Otherwise, they'd sort of, you know... I mean, miss full screen maybe half a dozen queer things, but they do tend to get lost in a very large program.
I do notice that Cloudburst is showing at the local Geelong Film Festival in a couple of weeks'
time.
Well,
that's like the little film that could, because we screened it opening night at the festival a couple of years back, and then we had a couple of back by popular demands, and then it was picked up by a very savvy Australian distributor, and he's just had it on screen for the last, you know, sort of 12 months across
the
country.
It's a fabulous film, that's why.
Fantastic film, and... you know, great that he took that risk. But, you know, all those... It's crucially important that filmmakers get the opportunity to screen at a queer film festival, but also just for us as audiences to be able to see things from all around the world. I mean, if we didn't have the queer film festival, there's no way you'd get to see 99% of this stuff. I mean, particularly the shorts.
Why do you think there is that drop in attendance? Do you think it's because of this idea that we don't need it, even if that's false, or is it to do with the finances and GFC? Why do you think that's happening?
Yeah, it's a little bit of everything. We actually haven't dropped audience. We just haven't grown the audience.
Okay,
I think we certainly need to grow the audience, because if you're not growing the audience, the expenses are... you know, skyrocketing all the time, you know.
So all you young kids who are in the 18 to 25 demographic, you should be coming along to this film festival, because you're actually going to see things that will inform you about both your history of your community and where the community is going, depending on what sort of films you'll see.
And other people as well, like, you know, members of people who are not part of the GLBT community and... as you say, because it's an opportunity to see films that otherwise people wouldn't be able to see.
Well, take your mum.
My mother's a very straight 73-year-old woman, comes to see sort of several things just because she finds them interesting, not because she has a lesbian daughter. She just wants to see interesting films.
She just doesn't want you moving back into the spare room, Lisa.
don't get me started. So, you know, you're right, though, that 18 to 25 age group is really hard for us to pin down. We've had our queries bent on film youth package, which is usually about four sessions across the festival. We've had that for 12 years and it still hasn't grown.
So, Lisa, what is that? Sorry?
It's called the Queries Bent on Film Youth Package. So we have about four to six sessions of films that are just purely devoted to an audience that's, say, under 25. And we actually get a special exemption from the classification board to screen to 16 and above. So that's our core audience for those four sessions. And they're short, you know, basically a mixed packages of shorts. But again, we've been knocking on the door of that for... We've had it for 12 years and really haven't increased the audience size at all. So
which film should people take their mum to see?
There's a fantastic film called Rosie, actually, that I've really enjoyed. It's about a gay guy who's sort of mid-40s, who's got a case of writer's block, and his mother, whose name is Rosie, who's sort of in her mid-80s, has had she's had a fall and she's sort of struggling, and he goes to visit her small hometown where he was brought up, and the expectation is that he will put her into a nursing home and then he'll go back to his big city life and go back to writing. But Rosie actually doesn't want to do that. She's a cantankerous old bitch and she just wants to stay where she is and expects him to sort of live there and look after her. And long story short, she has a very young, attractive male nurse, and the writer, who thinks that romance is not for him, forms this relationship with a younger nurse. And, you know...
Sounds a bit like a film that was on last year.
Yeah, it does actually. I'm just trying to think what that was called, but
it was a good film. It was an American film, and it was actually very good.
Yeah, this is actually probably even better than that one.
Oh, I mean, good.
But yeah, that is definitely taking your mother or grandmother too. So it's yeah, Rosie, and I think it's on the first weekend.
Oh, good. I'm putting that on my list.
Yes, Rosie's the star of the show. She's a cranky old bastard, but she's very funny.
Well, Lisa, I just wanted to say as well before we wrap up, but it's so, you know, storytelling is so important, I suppose, not just for our community, but for getting other people that hadn't otherwise thought about it. I know that when I was coming out to my family, my mum would always come home when she'd heard about a story about another family. And, you know, that goes right into filmmaking. That's exactly what it's about, like being able to empathise and see another story is just so paramount to getting people to empathise and understand.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, when you think about the queer community, what is that? I mean, it doesn't really actually exist, does it? I mean, it's not like we all live in the same place and have the same taste in clothes and fashion and music and food. We're a very diverse and eclectic bunch of people that just happen to have a sexuality issue in common. And so kind of trying to curate for a very diverse community is difficult when just that one thing is the sexuality that we have in common. So, you know, we try and have an incredibly diverse program, and I think there's something for everyone in the festival. So.
And where do we go to get tickets, Lisa?
Probably the best place is www.mqff.com.au, and we also have an iPhone and Android app. If you just look up Melbourne Queer Film Festival, you can buy tickets on that as well.
Oh, for all the youngins.
Excellent.
Yes, well, that should,
I will be doing that.
I'm so doing it. I really am.
Fantastic.
It's exciting.
Good. Thank you very much, Lisa, for coming on. And that was really good. I think it's an important festival for the community. And I congratulate you on your hard slog that you've been doing for the past 17 years or however it is long that you've been there without being poached by some other film festival.
And we don't
Thank
want
you.
It to go...
No.
So everyone buy tickets.
Yeah, buy some tickets. We need to sell some tickets.
And you can buy a 10-pack, which is a really good way of doing it, and just go to 10 films.
Yeah, 10, 7, 5 and 3, I think we've still got left. Yeah. So, yeah, get online, buy some tickets. Great festival.
Okay, everybody, so do that and email us on air at joy.org.au or text us on 0427JOY949 and tell us what you think and what you're going to go to in the film festival. And also, if you've got any questions for our resident skeptic, Tony Pittman, please ask any questions you want to ask about religion or creation or homeopathy, I think we're going to get stuck into tonight.
Joy 94.9 is a GLBTIQ community radio station in Melbourne, Australia. Support Joy 94.9 by becoming a member at joy.org.au.
You're with James, Kurt, Steph and Pat on Is Nothing Sacred? Joy 94.9.
Welcome back to Joy 94.9. This is James and it's Nothing Sacred. And also a shout out to our Star Observer Digital listeners. We've got a great discussion now with our resident skeptic here on Joy, Tony. Welcome, Tony.
Thank you very much.
We've talked about skepticism in some episodes past, but I suppose
ad nauseum a lot of the time on the show. Thank goodness.
Yeah, we thought we just wanted to maybe briefly touch on skepticism and what it actually means at its basis, because I think when I first came across the word skepticism, I got confused because of a hijacked word. Skepticism is in climate skepticism,
but which is not real skepticism. Yeah. They're deniers.
But you know, it certainly once I learnt about the way of thinking skeptically, I was blown away. So, what's your take on it, Tony?
Well, I mean, you're right that people use the term skeptic or skeptical in all kinds of contexts. But here, I guess what we're talking about is kind of the idea of scientific skepticism, which basically, for me, the definition of a skeptic is someone who bases their beliefs on evidence and, importantly, who changes their beliefs with changing evidence. Mm. So we don't have fixed beliefs and we're prepared. We have an open mind to change our beliefs if the evidence changes. So that's basically, in general terms, what a skeptic, a card-carrying kind of official skeptic would probably define themselves.
Are there really cards? Because I would quite like one of those.
There are. I have a card.
You can laminate them.
The way I loved hearing about skepticism was this idea when I was hearing from scientists and talking about, well, their whole profession is actually more about finding out the truth. So they might spend, you know, a particular scientist may spend years and years researching on a particular theory. Mm-hmm. And, you know, theoretically, the idea of this skepticism is that you would be constantly trying to disprove this idea. And if you couldn't disprove it and thought it was absolutely going to be right, but at the end of that, say, decade, a younger scientist came around and said, I've been able to disprove it with this whole new theory. And he'd go, walk up, shake his hand and say, thank you so much. That's been a fantastic thing. And I thought that idea is a really good one.
Yeah, exactly. That working together through science, we have come closer to learning the truth, learning about reality. And yeah, that's a very, very hard thing to do, to say that all these years when I was basing my beliefs or basing my research on one particular hypothesis I've had, oh, now 10 years down the line, I've discovered my hypothesis was wrong. Mm. But that's the whole point of science.
But I mean, one thing I just wanted to pick up on is use of the word truth, because like as I've talked about before, having worked in science previously as a biologist, people don't really talk about truth. Like the idea of scientists search for the truth is something that other people talk about rather than scientists themselves, for the exact reason that you were just talking about. Like if we think something is true and then we receive new evidence that it's not true, then it was never really truth. Therefore, we don't know if what we think is true actually is true. So we have things that we that are supported by evidence, or things that are, you know, we operate on the assumption that this is the way the world is because that's what all the indication is leading us to believe. You know, I can feel that there's a table there, therefore I feel pretty 99.99% confident there's a table there. There's a small postmodernist voice in my head going, but is it really?
Yeah.
I guess that's the nature of science, that science is really just about coming up with theories and then trying to disprove those theories. And as the theories become stronger and stronger, we are getting closer and closer. Our theories are getting closer and closer to describing reality.
Yes, that's a good way of putting it. Yes, describing reality, the world, the real world that we live in.
But the crux of it is that you have to be prepared to jettison belief, which the problem for people that are not sceptical is that they can't jettison belief. So people who have strong religious faith, for instance, can't jettison belief. And we had a discussion last week when we were talking about the big debate that went on UST public TV a couple of weeks ago between Keith Ham, the Australian from Queensland who runs the Creationist Museum in the States, and whoever the famous skeptic was that was debating him.
Yeah, Bill Nye.
Bill Nye. And when they asked them what would change their belief, Bill Nye said evidence, and the other guy said nothing.
Yeah, well, I suppose that's
which just proves that, you know, it's all these people that believe in things like homeopathy and stuff like that, and nothing's going to change their belief. Or people who believe in the stars and the star signs. And
I guess as skeptics, we generally do make a distinction between religion and then beliefs in the paranormal and pseudoscience, because religion, by definition, is based on faith, and faith, by definition, is belief without evidence.
Yeah.
So it's kind of pointless to argue with someone who bases their belief on
faith. But it's fun.
But I also think it's important to, as you say, separate, you know, religion, which is a lot of people find valuable and is kind of a separate issue to pseudoscience, which I personally feel can be quite dangerous if people are basing decisions in their life around pseudoscience rather than science.
I can hear Jim jumping in.
I don't think that it is a different to pseudoscience, because it's the basis of a lot of pseudoscience.
How about we go so far as to say that, my love of scientists, is quite evident. There are plenty of scientists around the world, though, Jim, and would need to acknowledge this, that for whatever reason, completely understand the scientific theory and very much part of it, discovering all of these things and advancing what we'd say is, you know, in quotes, truth and scientific knowledge. But at the same time, another part of them...
They're brainwashed, James. Brainwashed, yeah, no, that's but Jim, what I would say.
But they set it aside... I think it's silly. But they set aside another part of them where they are allowed to... Especially in the United States, a lot of scientists say that they are religious.
Well, the Catholic Church actually has scientists who are prepared to validate miracles, for instance.
I think, though, as a general rule, most religions would not claim to be scientific for the reason that you're saying, whereas pseudosciences do claim to be scientific. Yeah.
And generally, as an organised sceptical movement, generally sceptics only deal with religion when religions try to make claims about the real world, about how the world functions. And the classic examples of that kind of thing is creationism, where they try to impose teaching of creationism in science classes, and faith healing, where they kind of, you know...
kill their children.
Dupe people into believing that something is treating an illness when it's not.
But did you see the reports this week that said that 60% of Americans didn't believe that the Earth rotates around the sun, but that the sun rotates around the Earth?
Right, yeah, they always have those kind of surveys on scientific literacy, and it's always quite shocking when you read the statistics.
Unbelievable, isn't it?
It's certainly quite shocking.
Joy 94.9 is a GLBTIQ community radio station in Melbourne, Australia. Support Joy 94.9 by becoming a member at joy.org.au.
Is Nothing Sacred? With Pat, James, Kurt and Steph. Joy 94.9.
You're back. This is As Nothing Sacred. You're listening to Joy 94.9 and to our listeners on Star Observer Digital. We're continuing our discussion on scepticism, and we've had a good discussion on what sceptical minds are like and how science is an important way of discerning, you know, the universe around us. And I guess, continuing, Tony, we just want to go into some of the real issues that can potentially cause harm to people when other areas of medicine in particular encroach and make claims, you know, or false claims about science.
Yeah, well, I mean, I guess, yeah, they're the areas that concern me most, I guess, are the alternative medicines. Because skeptics generally deal with the psychics, the ghosts, the UFOs, the monsters, the astrology, stuff like that, which generally is not... If people believe in UFOs, it generally doesn't lead to harm or doesn't threaten their life.
Unless they all drink poison so they can join the Raelian...
like the Heaven's Gate, who suicided to go and join...
What was it? The UFO was behind the comet.
The comet, exactly, yeah. So, I mean, obviously, yeah, you can have all kinds of dangerous... People can take it to extremes.
But it's a minority.
Yeah, it's a minority.
I used to believe in UFOs and I'm fine. Supposedly, some say.
Don't judge me.
So
why medicine?
I guess the alternative medicines are probably of most concern to me and probably generally to the skeptical community, because people's health and ultimately people's lives can be at stake if they believe that an alternative medicine is effective when it's not.
So sort of like maybe not seeking help. So even if the thing doesn't cause you harm, if it doesn't do anything, it's about what you could have gone and seen a doctor and got proper medical help.
Yeah, exactly. For example, homeopathy doesn't work. It's not effective. If somebody believes it does, if maybe they've told, oh, take it for a headache or something, they might then believe it's effective. And then the risk is that if
they... Well, the placebo effect will come into play.
Well, yeah, the placebo effect can be very strong. And that reinforces their belief. And then the concern is that if they then get a more serious illness, they, if they're believing homeopathy is effective, they may delay going on to proper medicine and try to treat it with cancer or whatever they have with homeopathy. Or they may, like a woman in Western Australia a few years ago who... tried to treat her colon cancer only with homeopathy and obviously died. So it can lead to serious consequences.
So for those of us who don't know about homeopathy, if there is a brief way to say it, why I've heard that the claim is almost quite ridiculous. So what is there, what's it in a nutshell, what is it, why is it so absurd?
Well, homeopathy of the alternative medicines is probably the most absurd, and that is because homeopathy is based on It's based on ridiculous principles that are completely implausible. Firstly, that to treat a symptom, for example, fever, you need to take small amounts of a poison which causes that symptom. So that principle is wrong to start off with. And when they talk small amounts, they're talking that they mean that they dilute it so many times that not even one molecule of the original substance is left in the water. So you're either drinking water or you're eating a pure sugar pill, however you're taking the homeopathic medicine. So you're not taking anything.
I think we should get them all to take lead and arsenic.
Well, see, you can go and buy homeopathic remedies which will say on the label, arsenic or lead, diluted 10 to the power 30 times, which means there's no lead or arsenic in it, so you're perfectly safe.
So Tony, there's actually a campaign that's gone on. I'm not sure if you heard about it, which is basically talking about overdosing on particular homeopathic drugs. You know, for instance, their sleeping pills, taking a whole, you know, 50 of their sleeping pills and then waiting for something to happen. That, and nothing ever does.
Yeah, that's the 1023
campaign. Is that whole concept?
Eventually, people will go to sleep because they'll get bored.
Yeah. I think the tagline is what? 10 to the power of 23, which proves it's wrong, number one. And number two is there's nothing in it.
Exactly. Homeopathy, quite literally. There's nothing in it. Exactly. Okay. Yeah, so that's one way that people, a public event to try to show people that literally there's nothing in homeopathy. They're just sugar pills.
So is there anything more serious that, you know, because homeopathy obviously is a problem when people, because they think they're getting treatment, but it's just a sugar pill, essentially. Mm-hmm. Are there examples of ones where they actually cause potential harm?
Well, I guess in homeopathy, probably not, because it's always very diluted. But, you know,
so
there
in
are.
Others.
Yeah, in for example, in Indian Ayurvedic medicine, which is a traditional medicine from India, not science based, based on dogma from hundreds or thousands of years ago. And a lot of those remedies, and in traditional Chinese medicine as well, a lot of those remedies, when they're tested, sometimes they can have high mercury levels, high lead levels. Mm. There's no quality control or testing of these so-called remedies.
Well, there's no way of measuring the dosage that people are getting of them either. So that if they've got something in them that is pharmaceutically potent, you don't know whether you're getting the same dose every time you take it, or whether you're getting a really high dose sometimes and a really low dose other times.
Yeah, that's the problem with herbs. Yeah, that if you just buy a herbal supplement, you don't know what part of the plant it was taken from, what treatment they did to the leaf. So yeah, you have no idea if there is any active ingredient or how much is in it.
The most benefit that anybody gets from it is the manufacturers of those products. They get a big bank balance.
There's a British author, Ben Goldacre, who writes a lot about this. He has a blog, and he's also written a book called Bad Science, and also one called, anyway, it's about Big Pharma. I'm not sure if it's called Big Pharma. But he goes into quite a lot of detail, particularly about homeopathy, and does experiments to show why people believe that particular things can be true.
Bark flower remedies.
The what?
The bark flower remedies.
What's the bark flower remedies? Well,
one of these things where you take the essence of flowers, and some flowers are meant to make you feel better or meant to ward off depression and all sorts of things. People take these small drops of things that come in these bottles that you pay a fortune for, and you drop it into water and you drink it, and that's supposed to ward off the evilness of illness.
So
warding off the evil spirits, yeah, really.
I mean, those ones sound completely implausible, but Jim, it's reminded me of something you said earlier, actually off air, which was about the fact that you know, for those of our listeners who actually have heard that there is some good things that have come out of Chinese medicine, for instance, you were talking about aspirin before, and this is this idea that modern medicine doesn't actually discriminate against these particular old styles of medicine as long as they have been proven to have an effect. Is that correct?
If any of these so-called treatments would subject themselves to scientific rigor and method, then they'd be able to be tested, and we'd be able to say they do have a, they might have a benefit.
As aspirin, is that right?
Aspirin came from the herbal remedy of willow bark, because willow bark has the ingredient in it that is the active ingredient in aspirin.
But I mean, something else that is sort of I think interesting to raise here is that a lot of the medicines that we do use come from the natural world anyway. You know, if you think about like opium poppies, that's, you know, maybe not a drug that we'd
well, morphine comes from that.
Yeah, but I think this kind of separation between things that are natural and things that are manufactured is a little bit more fuzzy than people might believe.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, that fallacy is very common. It's called the naturalistic fallacy, the idea that natural, in inverted commas, means that something is somehow safe or gentle or somehow better than a, you know, a pure pharmaceutical product.
Well, salmonella's it's natural.
Just false. Exactly, salmonella. Arsenic's natural.
And guess what? I saw a fabulous meme on my Facebook page yesterday that said, uranium, gluten-free.
There you go. And natural.
It is.
100%
uranium.
Natural.
It is.
You can find more Joycasts and show blogs. Go to joy.org.au.
You're with Steph, James, Kurt and Pat on Is Nothing Sacred? Joy 94.9.
You are on Joy 94.9 and this has been Is Nothing Sacred for the past hour. And we've had a couple of very interesting guests tonight. We had Lisa Daniel. Thank you, Lisa, if you're still listening, talking about the Melbourne Queer Film Festival, of which she is the artistic director. And we've had Tony Pittman, who has been talking to us all about skepticism and stuff. Tony, do you want to tell listeners where they can hear you more often?
Yes, with pleasure. I do actually, I used to do a weekly skeptical show here at Joy 94.9, and now I do that show.
We've jumped in and stolen your
You've
spot off.
Stolen my slot. Well, now I do that as a podcast, and that show is called Reality Check, and you can find it on the Joy 94.9 website.
Or on iTunes.
Or on iTunes, yep, Reality Check.
Or on that Android site that does some podcasting, what I can't remember
probably.
The name of it too.
And if people want to join, because there's an official Australian Skeptics group, is there not?
There is.
There is indeed. And, yep, there's a Victorian Skeptics branch of that. I can't remember the website, but if you just Google Vic Skeptics or Australian Skeptics, you can find the website. And I should mention a couple of other weekly podcasts, which if you're interested in skepticism or learning more, definitely, and you like podcasts, definitely check them out. One is called The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe.
Oh, great couple.
Which is fantastic. And another is called Skeptoid, which is a bit shorter and deals with individual topics. But they're great introductions to critical thinking and skepticism.
Well, listeners, you can expect to hear Tony on this show again soon, I would say. And especially when he's got something on his podcast that he wants to get out and about. And thanks, Steph, for coming back from Sydney to be with us tonight.
Right off the plane,
yes.
Fresh.
Steph's
very
been doing
committed.
Interpretive dance in here all night, people. She's even wearing the right clothes for it.
No, that's not true. What actually happened is that Jim asked during the song, do we have to talk when the song finishes? And I said, yes, Jim, it's radio. So I offered him to do some interpretive dance. He declined. So we'll be working on that. Maybe
but
we can
I have
put it
been,
up.
I've been, in my mind, I've been watching Steph interpretive dance.
Also, I think,
all
I don't think
studio.
Interpretive dance would be very good on radio because it might sound like this. It's not very interesting, is it?
And thanks, James. And thank you, Kurt, for panelling. And thank you, Tony, for coming in.
My pleasure.
After us, of course, the next show is Into the Woods with the Bears, with Mark and the Bears. And they're going to be having an interview with their with Where the Bears Are people that Mark has done during the week. So that should be quite interesting. And that will be on after we've finished. So thank you to everybody that's been here. And hello, Pat and Sydney. I assume you've managed to stick out the whole hour of listening to us. And we shall see you next week with another big show.
And don't forget to see Jim's movie.
Oh, and don't forget to go to MQFF and see 52 Tuesdays, which is on the 18th of March.
Then you'll be able to picture his lovely face every time he talks to you on radio.
Or
what's
alternatively,
yours called?
Go to see, in the Oz Docs program, go to see Some Rainbows Never Grey, because I'm one of the subjects for that. Hello, Peter Jacobson, if you're out there listening. I'm one of the subjects of that documentary, which is about older gay men, because old people like me actually do get onto Joy and play inappropriate music just occasionally.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy.
Help us keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.